And now we turn to another business that was feeling threatened recently, the oyster business. Legend has it that raw oysters are good for love, but they're also good for a fight, as the Food and Drug Administration just learned. The FDA proposed to treat oysters from the Gulf of Mexico to rid them of a potentially deadly bacteria. Then the FDA came under pressure. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
The FDA met its fiercest resistance in Louisiana, the nation's top oyster producer. At Casamento's restaurant, a New Orleans fixture since 1919, customers were outraged when the FDA said Gulf oysters would have to be treated from April to October if they're intended to be eaten raw. Nancy Chachery just finished off a dozen on the half shell.
It's part of our culture. It's what we eat. I mean, I remember as a child going fishing and eating oysters right out of the boat, out of the water. You know, the idea of having to radiate them or whatever it is that they want to do is ridiculous.
The FDA proposed the post-harvest treatment to curtail the average 15 deaths per year caused by Vibrio vulnificus, a naturally occurring bacteria found in warm water oysters. Vibrio can be fatal for people with compromised immune systems, including diabetics, alcoholics, and people with liver disease. But Casamento's owner, C.J. Gerdes, says he wouldn't serve processed oysters.
No taste to them. They taste like rubber. So I wouldn't use them. I would just go without.
About two-thirds of the oysters eaten in the United States come from the Gulf of Mexico. Regulators say more than a decade of trying to educate at-risk consumers about Vibrio has not worked, so they want to get rid of the threat. Michael Taylor is a senior advisor to the FDA commissioner.
We have a public health duty to act when there's a means to really prevent very serious illnesses and death.
But instead of requiring post-harvest treatment in 2011 as planned, the FDA last week did an about-face and now says it will study the feasibility and cost first. That after feeling the heat from oyster growers, consumers, and Gulf Coast lawmakers. Gulf Oyster Industry Council board member Mike Voisin says it would have been catastrophic for oyster growers. His company, Motivated Seafood in Houma, Louisiana, already treats oysters, but he says most mom-and-pop oyster shops can't afford the equipment and shouldn't be forced to.
We don't live in a nanny state. We don't have to be protected from everything. It makes no sense.
The industry's argument doesn't make sense to Jenny Bourgeois of Baton Rouge. Her father died from the flesh-eating bacteria 2 years ago after having raw oysters at his 60th birthday dinner.
I can't imagine that they would actually put an economic value over how much the lives of 15 or more individuals are worth.
Fourth-generation Louisiana oysterman John Tesfitch is one grower who says warning at-risk consumers is not enough.
That's the wrong position to take. You're in the food business.
When the public health debate over Vibrio got national attention in the mid-1990s, Tesfitch started AmeriPure, an oyster pasteurization company. Here at the Franklin, Louisiana plant, sacks of oysters are cleaned and secured with a rubber band before being dunked into a giant hot water tank.
The secret is controlling the temperature accurately to kill the bacteria without cooking the oyster.
The oyster is still raw, but no longer alive. It has a slightly stronger flavor and firmer texture than unprocessed oysters. AmeriPure sells up to 20 million pounds of treated oysters a year and counts among its customers some of the nation's top seafood chains. Tesfitch thinks the industry should stop fighting health officials.
Illnesses and deaths being associated with your product keep us down. It hurts our marketability.
But the Gulf oyster industry won this round in its battle with the FDA. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
And now let's canoodle on over to a lighter story. Last week, after my interview with the owner of the popular New York noodle bar Momofuku, we asked you to send in your ramen noodle stories. And who knew? Those cheap little blocks of instant noodles with the silver foil flavor packet. Well, it turns out they serve up a big steaming bowl of nostalgia. We got so many stories, so many good stories, that we need a limit on how many to share with you right now. And the limit? As many stories as we can fit into the time it takes to fix a bowl of ramen. Once the water boils, that's about 3 minutes, so let's go. Keeve Spare of Lawrence, Kansas says his dad made ramen noodles for him and his sister. As kids, he writes, they called the meal Roman numerals. My dad would mix the noodles with a can of vegetable soup. We thought it was a delicacy. That's not far off from what Natalie McQueen's husband did in college. Writing us from Sunnydale, California, she says her husband would mix in frozen vegetables or chili with his ramen. Natalie says the chili ramen dish became a staple of his diet until the chili started giving him excess gas. Ah, TMI! Well, to keep peace with his roommates, he switched to Dinty Moore beef stew and Stoodles was born. Natalie goes on to tell us that her kids regularly request Stoodles for their birthday meal. Ramen saved the day and helped season the catch for Tom Siaglo of Louisville, Colorado. Staying at his lakeside cabin, Tom had to figure out how to cook a trout his son caught. The problem, he had no ingredients for the batter except, yes, you guessed it, instant ramen. Tom pulverized the ramen into something that passed for flour.
I had some bad beer, so we added a little of that to make the batter tasty enough to stick on the fish. Oh yeah, and the flavor packet? We, of course, had to throw that in for just the proper seasoning. We dipped the rainbow fillets in the batter, grilled them, and they were delicious. Our new favorite recipe at the cabin now is house-made ramen-encrusted trout with flavor packet. Ramen, the duct tape of fast food.
Well, not just duct tape. Dried ramen also happens to make great packing material. That's how Cindy Maggie of Spokane, Washington, first encountered it in 1972. She says, my father was in Vietnam, and he would send big boxes home to us. In these boxes were wooden platters and bowls and brassware. She said those gifts were cushioned with packages of dried ramen, and Cindy's dad suggested his family cook them up. They did, and they loved it. Cindy adds, I've always thought that ramen was the only positive thing we got out of the Vietnam War. Okay, our noodles are almost done, so time for just two more stories. Beth White is a retired middle school teacher from Orono, Maine. For her, thoughts of ramen noodles curl back to the 1980s and some very hungry students.
The kids love the idea of just gobbling it up, crunchy and uncooked, just putting it all in their mouth. They'd also open the seasoning packet, they'd pour some of that into their mouth. Well, it drove us crazy because they were eating it dry, so they would be thirsty for hours afterwards. And the worst thing than that was that they would have terribly, terribly bad breath from eating the seasoning packets without any water. We teachers, along with the other students, we got the brunt of the bad breath.
Ew. Well, we're trying to beat the clock, so I better pick up the pace. Finally, this from Stephanie Brimo of Chicago. She told us about her first job. She loved ramen noodles so much, she skipped going to lunch with coworkers. Stephanie writes, my boss passed me by and noticed the ramen noodles. He approached me in all seriousness and asked if they were paying me enough. Well, Stephanie, hope you got a raise out of that. The noodles are done, and so are our stories. But you can read more and get some great suggestions on how to dress up your ramen noodles. One involves a waffle iron. You got to read it to believe it. You'll find it at npr.org. Bon appetit. The makers of alcoholic energy drinks have long insisted their products are safe. Today, they got this message from the Food and Drug Administration. Prove it. NPR's Joseph Shapiro reports.
Those drinks mix caffeine with malt liquor, then add peach, berry, and other sweet fruit flavors. They're popular on college campuses and heavily marketed to 20-somethings. But is this really a good idea, to drink something that can get you very drunk and keep you awake at the same time? Now the Federal Food and Drug Administration is demanding proof that the products are safe. Joshua Sharfstein is the second-ranking official at the FDA.
The agency has asked nearly 30 manufacturers of caffeinated alcoholic beverages to provide FDA within 30 days the data necessary to demonstrate that caffeine can be safely and lawfully added to alcoholic beverages.
The FDA will then consider the response from those companies as well as other scientific evidence, and then decide whether the drinks can be sold or whether they need to be pulled from the market while the FDA does its own formal review. There's no timetable for how long the FDA takes to decide. But the FDA got applause from 19 states' attorneys general. They'd pursued legal action against the drink makers. Richard Blumenthal is the attorney general for Connecticut.
No question, this FDA is a different being. It's much more proactive and interventionist when it comes to protecting public health and a major potential ally rather than an adversary as the old FDA was.
Up until now, those state officials had succeeded in getting two big beer makers to change their products. Last year, Anheuser-Busch took the caffeine out of its drink Tilt, and Miller Coors did the same with Sparks, saying it disagreed with the criticism from the attorneys general, but said they were acting as a responsible company. Still, as the big beer makers stepped out, smaller ones proliferated. They sell drinks with up to twice or more the alcohol of most beers. Calls to several of the companies were not returned. Dr. Mary Claire O'Brien at Wake Forest University School of Medicine studied the use of those drinks by college students.
But it's safe to say that a quarter of college drinkers are mixing alcohol with energy drinks, including both pre-mixed products as well as products that they mix themselves.
O'Brien's study also found that the drinks encourage binge drinking and other high-risk behaviors that can lead to car crashes and sexual assaults. She first saw the problem one night working in the emergency room. A college student was brought in so drunk he was nearly comatose. Hours later, when he woke up, he told her he'd been mixing caffeine and alcohol.
And I said, why would you want to drink caffeine to stay awake and drink alcohol to make you sleepy? Why would you do that at the same time? He said, oh, so you can drink more and stay up later. And just the light bulb went off. I thought, oh, my God, people are not just drinking because they're drinking. They're drinking to party longer, to drink greater quantities for longer periods of time. And exactly what happened to this kid. He had an extraordinarily high level of alcohol in his system.
O'Brien thinks the drink makers will have a hard time showing the FDA that their products are safe.
There are no data. I've reviewed the scientific literature. There is not a body of scientific evidence to support that adding caffeine to alcohol is safe. We don't have to prove it's unsafe. They have to prove it's safe. That's the law.
O'Brien published her study in 2007. Two other studies found similar results. But since then, more and more alcoholic energy drinks have gone on the market. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
In New England, the tradition of hard cider, artisan style, goes back to the Founding Fathers. John Adams wrote in his diary about the digestive benefits of drinking a tankard of cider each morning. Well, now a New Hampshire apple grower is hoping to revive that tradition and provide a lifeline to struggling farmers. From New Hampshire Public Radio, Avishai Artsy has that story.
On a late fall day, the production floor at Poverty Lane Orchards in Lebanon, New Hampshire, is bustling. A half dozen seasonal employees from Jamaica grind the apples, press the juice, and add yeast. William Crawford is one of them.
This is the cider tank, beautiful tank. You see how it shine. Try to keep the juice good.
Owner Steve Wood began converting his orchards to cider apples 20 years ago. Red Delicious apples from Washington State and cheap imports from China were flooding the market.
You know, we were growing the same fruit and getting the same praise we had done before, but we weren't getting as much money, and it was clear we couldn't keep doing it.
Many apple growers switched to other crops. In two decades, the acreage of apple trees in New Hampshire dropped by nearly half to 2,100. So Wood hatched a plan, recruit other apple growers to resurrect New England's long-dormant cider tradition.
Growers come here, and I give them grafting wood. I give them whatever they want to help them get started. We don't play our cards very close to the breast. I'll tell anybody exactly what we do and how we do it.
Chuck Souther and his wife operate Apple Hill Farm in Concord, New Hampshire. Souther decided about 6 years ago to take Wood's advice and convert 2 acres of his land to growing cider apples.
Which was a little bit of a leap of faith. Almost all the other apples we grow, we can do various things with them. These apples are inedible. They are high in tannin, high in acids. There is a strong sort of retch factor when you eat one. I liken it to biting into a fresh cranberry.
Souther hopes to be federally licensed to sell fine cider by the end of the winter, but Wood says other growers won't be able to make that leap.
They can't do it because they are so financially strapped that they can't raise the capital to change once again, to replant once again.
Wood's label is called Farnham Hill Ciders, and it's received favorable reviews in the New York Times and Wine Enthusiast, but distributors are skeptical about the demand for fine cider, and some retailers are placing his bottles on the bottom shelves alongside Manischewitz.
it's a long job. It's a long job to develop a market where there is none.
That's why Wood sends employees to hold tastings at grocery stores, like at the Cracker Barrel Market in Hopkinton, New Hampshire. Carl Goodman ventured a taste.
Dry, sparkling, and a little different. Very drinkable.
Despite the long odds, Wood envisions New England becoming the Napa Valley of fine cider production. It wouldn't be unprecedented. It was the drink of choice of American colonists, and John Adams was said to consume a tankard a day. In that sense, Wood is like a modern-day Johnny Appleseed, who, by the way, planted cider apple trees. For NPR News, I'm Avishai Artsy.